KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana Governor Greg Gianforte's office met with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes and local officials last week to settle a dispute over law enforcement funding on the Flathead Reservation. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has the latest.
For years, Lake County has sought state funding to cover its cost for enforcing and prosecuting felonies on the reservation. It's exercised that authority under a decades-old agreement with the state and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. The county is once again backing legislation that would fund its law enforcement services for tribal members, but Commissioner Gail Decker says this time is different.
The county is saying, fund us until the state can retrocede and the feds can come in and take it over.
That bill would give the county a little more than half of what it says it costs to police the reservation over the next 2 years. The state intends to pull out of the law enforcement agreement known as Public Law 280, but the timeline is unknown. Gianforte's office did not respond to a request for comment about whether it supports temporary funding for Lake County. If both the county and state pull out, it'll be left up to the tribes and the federal government to provide law enforcement. The tribes have taken over more felony cases, but it's unclear if they are able to take every case. Federal officials have long said they do not have the resources to spare for the reservation. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
An author of a new report says institutions need to do more to close the higher education graduation gap for Native Americans. As Isabel Charlet reports, that includes in Oregon, where there are some efforts to boost higher education among Native students.
The report notes at just 25%, Native Americans have the lowest college-going rate of any racial group in the country. Cheryl Crazy Bull with the American Indian College Fund, who helped author the report, recommends states set specific higher education goals focused on increasing Native participation. She adds they should prioritize direct engagement with tribes and schools to provide resources, as well as expanding recruitment practices.
Those practices can often exclude Native students who live in reservation, rural areas, as well as urban Native students.
In 2022, Oregon made public universities free for Native students enrolled in one of the state's 9 federally recognized tribes through the Oregon Tribal Stewardship Grant. The program has been gaining steam over the years, but the graduation gap, made larger during the pandemic, has not closed. While Crazy Bull says financial barriers play a big part in preventing Native people from accessing higher education, she adds not all issues can be solved with money.
Institutions create a place or a sense of belonging for students. That's just a constant.
Native students can apply for the Oregon Tribal Stewardship Grant until April, as long as funds are available. I'm Isabel Charlet.
Former Interior Secretary Deb Haaland is running for governor of New Mexico. The announcement was made in a video which was launched Tuesday. In the video, Haaland talks about her time in Congress and at the Interior Department, saying, among things she worked on in the state, helping open small businesses, expanding solar power, and bringing water to rural communities. Her platform for governor includes lowering costs for families, improving schools, and addressing crime prevention. Haaland, a Pueblo woman, made history becoming one of the first Native American women to serve in Congress and the first Native person to hold the position of Secretary of the Interior. Haaland says in the coming weeks, she'll be traveling the state to hear directly from community members. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You then call into question the legitimacy of your courts. That's not a recipe for good governance.
Senator Murkowski says the Trump administration doesn't have the constitutional authority to dismantle agencies Congress created. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, lawmakers work to reinstate a pension plan for state employees.
We believe this plan will be the most risk-averse retirement plan in the country.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is important to many rural Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying to serve on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Apply by Sunday, February 16th. More information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@ios.doi.gov. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
President Trump and his designated spending slasher Elon Musk are hacking away at the federal government in the name of efficiency. Senator Lisa Murkowski says they're overreaching their constitutional powers and she wants Congress to assert its authority. But as Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, Murkowski offered no sure way to draw a line that Trump can't cross.
Congress created the agencies Musk and the Trump administration are targeting, and the programs they're slashing, humanitarian aid overseas, disaster aid at home, education programs, science research, all funded by bills Congress passed. Murkowski says the U.S. Constitution gives the president a lot of power, but also gives specific powers to Congress.
To have the executive basically come in and dismantle something that was legislatively created, that's outside the bounds of the executive. So it requires us in the legislative branch to then assert our responsibility, which is to not cede the authority. And
how do you do that?
Well, you got to claim it back.
Murkowski cited as an example congressional earmarks. Congress used to send money to agencies with a lot of instructions about where and how to spend it, but that came to be seen as pork barrel politics. So for a decade, Congress didn't earmark. It just sent money to the government agencies and let them decide which projects to fund. Starting in 2021, Congress reclaimed its power to earmark. That assertion of congressional power, though, didn't require taking on the Trump administration.
But how do you push back on the dismantling of departments or agencies?
Well, right now what you're seeing is litigation.
Lawsuits. Judges and ultimately the Supreme Court could tell Trump not to tread on the authority of Congress. Murkowski recognizes the problem of relying on the courts to rein in the president. It only works if the president abides by it.
You're now having some in the executive branch saying, we don't think the courts should be deciding this. We think that this is our authority. You then call into question the legitimacy of your courts. That's not a recipe for good governance.
Some scholars and law professors put it in harsher terms. They say we're heading for a constitutional crisis if we're not in one already. Trump, in the Oval Office with Musk at his side, didn't sound worried that a judge would stop him from what he characterizes as rooting out waste and fraud.
And it seems hard to believe that a judge could say, we don't want you to do that. Well, so maybe we have to look at the judges, because that's a very serious, I think it's a very serious violation.
At the Capitol Monday, Senator Dan Sullivan didn't stop to take a question about Musk's dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development.
Sir, would you talk to me about USAID?
I will get back to you with that question.
Hi, Senator. How are you?
It's hard to hear because Sullivan was walking away, but he said he'd get back to me, and he told another reporter he couldn't comment on the cuts to grants from the National Institutes of Health because he hadn't seen them. Some of the cuts to USAID hit close to home for Sullivan. He's the chairman of a nonprofit called the International Republican Institute, which fosters democracy overseas. It has received millions of dollars in USAID grants. His office did not respond to our questions in time for this story. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
As state lawmakers continue to work through an education funding package, members of the House are turning to another priority for the session. That's reforming the retirement system for state and local government employees. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone has this look at a bill that would return public sector workers to a defined benefit pension system.
First things first, if you're thinking this looks anything like the state's prior pension systems, well, House Majority Leader Chuck Kopp says, think again.
This is structurally so different that it's barely recognizable. It'd be like comparing a rotten apple on an old tree to a robust pear on a living tree. They're both fruit, but it ends there.
For decades, the state provided a generous pension to public employees, like cops, teachers, firefighters, snowplow drivers, and so on. Over the years, though, lawmakers trimmed the program. Then, in 2006, the state closed it off entirely. Cops says that was due to poor advice from the state's contracted actuaries and a cover-up that wound up in court, and all resulted in state lawmakers badly underfunding the program and creating a spiral of unfunded pension and health care liabilities the state is still reckoning with years later. Lawmakers replaced the pension system with a 401k-style defined contribution program. In that system, the worker chips in a percentage of their paycheck. That's theirs to keep, regardless of how long they stick around. Then the employer puts in another fraction that's a little bit more restricted, until 5 years in, when the employee is vested and can take that cash with them when they leave. Kopp says that's a powerful signal to the state's public sector workforce.
We've created a system that points to a value of leaving at 5 years. Beyond that, you don't have a value for retaining employees.
Kopp says it's showing up in retirement system data. Many workers are happy to skip town for higher paying jobs elsewhere.
90% of these withdrawals coming right after the 5-year mark or when someone was 100% vested. So employees are cashing out and moving on.
And Kopp says that means Alaskans miss out on some of the most productive periods of public servants' careers. Teachers, he says, are more effective after spending a few years in the classroom. Kopp, who is a retired police officer himself, says most officers take 2 years of on-the-job training before they can work without close supervision.
By the time you hit 5 years, you're becoming really valuable. And if those 5-year people are going to one of the other 49 states with a more competitive retirement program, which we'll hear from testimony that they are, that's a challenge.
Citing research presented to Senate lawmakers last year, Kopp says a new pension system would do better at retaining those mid and late career workers who know the most about how to do their jobs, whether that's running the engine room on a ferry or teaching a class of rowdy seventh graders. The system proposed in House Bill 78 builds on what advocates are calling a shared risk model. It would ratchet contributions up and down depending on how well the state's pension fund performs. So if it's looking like the pension fund is running short of its obligations, the employee and the employer would each have to contribute more. And retirees would shoulder some risk, too. The state could withhold inflation adjustments on pension payments to keep the plan solvent. Kopp says it borrows from the lessons of other pension systems in states around the country.
We believe this plan will be the most risk-averse retirement plan in the country.
The plan is getting a hard look from House lawmakers. One question is how much the plan would cost, and that will likely be a big subject of debate in the weeks to come. Last year, different estimates from different sources with different assumptions and different methodologies came to, you guessed it, wildly different results. They ranged from, it'll basically come out in the wash every year, to more than $1 billion over a decade plus. But another area of skepticism is over whether a pension would actually make a dent in the state's struggle to hire and retain workers. Ketchikan Republican Representative Jeremy Bynum, who led the electric division of Ketchikan's public utility, says the retirement plan wasn't the main factor driving turnover.
The biggest issues that drove employees where I was at away was the cost of living in the community. It was being able to afford their home. It was being able to make sure that their kids had a good school to go to and that their schools were taken care of. It was the remoteness of being in Alaska.
The bill is a priority for House leadership and for Kopp personally. Kopp says his predecessor's refusal to advance a pension bill was the biggest factor pushing him to run for office again. Senator Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican who shepherded a pension bill through the Senate last year, says she expects the Senate to take a closer look at the bill once it passes the House. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, officials warn Juneau residents about a potential calving event at the Mendenhall Glacier.
There's really no way for us to predict when it's going to fall, and we really don't know what the scale is going to be either.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You can make a difference in the lives of Alaskans. Every year, hundreds of nonprofits provide warm meals, safe places, and resources to hundreds of thousands of Alaskans. By supporting Alaska's nonprofits when you apply for your PFD, you're giving more opportunity, more hope, more chances. This year, make more possible with the click of a button. Don't forget to give via PickClick Give when you apply for your PFD. This message sponsored by PickClick Give.
The number of non-residents working in Alaska hit a new record in 2023, and all major industries are relying more heavily on workers who do not live in the state, according to the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The Alaska Beacon reports non-resident workers in Alaska totaled over 90,000 in 2023 and made up nearly one quarter of the workforce. That's the highest percentage in three decades. The increased reliance on non-resident workers coincides with a 12-year streak of net outmigration, meaning more people left the state than moved in, as well as a loss of working-age adults. The biggest percentage increase in non-resident employment in 2023 was in the construction sector. Construction job growth has largely been driven by projects funded through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act of 2021 and by increased oil activity. The most dramatic increase in non-resident construction hiring was on the North Slope, where the non-resident construction workforce nearly tripled from 2022 to 2023. The U.S. Forest Service is warning Juneau residents to stay away from the face of the Mendenhall Glacier, where a large piece of ice may fall off at any moment. Forest Service spokesperson Paul Robbins Jr. said in an interview earlier today that it's difficult to predict how dangerous the calving may be, but it's best to steer clear.
There's really no way for us to predict when it's going to fall, and we really don't know what the scale is going to be either.
This comes as hundreds of Juneau residents have flocked to recreate on the frozen lake in recent weeks. The Juneau Nordic Ski Club grooms cross-country skiing trails on it, and walking paths in the snow lead toward the face of the glacier. Capital City Fire and Rescue Chief Rich Etheridge says his department is aware of the warning and is advising residents to stay off the lake entirely. He says a rescue mission would be extremely difficult to pull off and could put rescuers at risk.
Our recommendation is stay off the ice until this large chunk gives way. It's beautiful and everybody wants to be out there, but is it really worth the risk of being stuck out there in that freezing water and which could very well be a fatal event?
Every winter, the Forest Service advises residents that venturing out onto the frozen lake can be dangerous. In December, when the ice first froze over, several reports of people falling through the ice and self-rescuing circulated on social media. Robbins says the glacier has had significant calving activity in recent weeks, with multiple sections already falling onto the frozen lake.
Yeah, the major dangers are in the immediate vicinity of the glacial face from large chunks of ice falling and the possibility of crushing individuals that could be nearby. And of course, to when those large chunks of ice hit the iced over lake below, it could cause cracks and make the ice unstable for people who would be skiing or skating across it.
A video shared on social media in December showed Juneau residents running across the ice away from the face of the glacier after a large chunk of ice calved, causing the lake ice to flex and crack. The National Weather Service typically advises that people keep a distance of at least 300 yards from the face of the glacier. Well, hatchery production of chum and pink salmon will continue as usual this year in Southeast. After many tense hours of testimony and deliberation at its annual meeting in Ketchikan, the Alaska Board of Fisheries rejected yet another attempt to curb the size of hatchery releases of chum and pink salmon into the wild. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The hatchery debate touches on the biggest unknown in salmon ecology, what occurs in the ocean between a salmon's birth and when it returns to spawn. Proposal 156 was submitted to the Board of Fish by Virgil Umpenauer, a member of the Fairbanks Region Fish and Game Advisory Committee, and some form of the same idea has come before the board at least four previous times. Umpenauer believes that the millions upon millions of chum and pink released into the wild by hatcheries in Southeast Alaska every year are affecting the marine environment to the detriment of wild stocks of other species, like Chinook in western Alaska. He proposed that the Board of Fish cut back hatchery releases in Southeast by 25%. Stakeholders in Southeast packed the board's meeting last week to oppose the plan.
Just line up, folks, because we got a long room.
That's member Mike Wood chairing a committee of the whole when the board steps away for a bit to take a deeper dive into related proposals. Proposal 156 generated only 10 favorable comments from the public and 400 opposed. Sitka troller Jackie Foss was one of them.
Like any operation, you need diversification in order to be profitable, and this would take a major pillar from our ability to be profitable.
The short story is that while king salmon make the headlines, hatchery-produced chum salmon have become an economic mainstay in the Southeast troll fishery. They've increased significantly in value over the last decade or more, and some of the returns have been just staggering. Millions of chum returning to a release site in West Crawfish Inlet in 2018 was a bonanza for trollers from around the region. Many stakeholders objected that someone from Fairbanks would try to roll back this kind of economic opportunity.
Heather Bauscher, Petersburg AC. We were in unanimous opposition to this. Initial concerns were that the proposer is not from this region and doesn't understand the impacts that this would have for communities.
Keenan Sanderson with the Tlingit and Haida Community Council has a degree in salmon ecology. He thought the proposal's 25% cut in hatchery production was ill-conceived.
You're not going just to see a reduction in salmon, but you're going to see a reduction in marine mammals. You're going to see a reduction in salmon sharks and pretty much everything that uses salmon as a food resource.
Others testified that more than the ecosystem would be affected. Steve Reifenstuhl is the former general manager of the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, one of two large hatcheries in the area. He felt that the economics of fishing would change.
Overall, any cut would affect coho and Chinook production. They don't pay the bills. They're very expensive. They don't really return one-to-one. It's less than one-to-one in terms of benefit cost. So that has to come from somewhere. So a cut in pink and chum would result in lowering budgets for coho and Chinook.
Reifenstuhl reminded the board that over 100 pages of scientific literature had been submitted showing that there was no linkage between Southeast hatchery production and salmon returns to the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. But board member Curtis Chamberlain disagreed. He believed there was a growing correlation between the size of hatchery releases in Southeast and the weight and ages of wild stocks harvested elsewhere around the state.
None of the scientific articles cited in opposition to Proposal 156 disputed this correlation, but instead cited other causes of mortality that are not within the board's control or correlations that touch on the broader carrying capacity issue.
Chamberlain offered a compromise. He proposed cutting pink production by only 7% and chums by 20%. When the Board of Fish met in full the following day to vote on the proposal, most members found the idea of any reduction in hatchery production to be arbitrary. Member Tom Carpenter from Cordova remained unconvinced.
I think that it's imperative that the board, when they make decisions like this,
only member Stan Zaray from Tanana joined Chamberlain in supporting the reduction. Zaray has a 25-year history watching the emergence of hatchery programs and observing changes in the ecosystems and economies on the rivers.
I am very frustrated as I read the preponderance of peer-reviewed studies showing possible harm from the present Alaska hatchery biomass in the ocean. So many Alaska fishermen's lives and families now depend on hatcheries. I do not believe this is what the original intent of hatcheries was.
Zaray said that Alaska's hatcheries should never have been allowed to grow to the point where they were needed to sustain Alaska's fisheries. Proposal 156 failed 2-5, with members Zaray and Chamberlain in favor. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education. How does Alaska's land fund community services for Alaskans with behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities? Through the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Trust Land Office manages 1 million acres of lands to maximize revenue generation, with earnings supporting millions of dollars in trust grant making each year to help improve mental health outcomes for beneficiaries statewide. More at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
A log, destined to become the new finish line arch for the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, is drying in Willow. Its predecessor crumbled in Nome last April. But as KNOM's Ben Townsend reports, the new log, perhaps poetically, was found near mile one of the historic Iditarod Trail.
From the ground, 26-time Iditarod finisher and log home builder Ramey Smith stares up at the one.
We wanted to have multiple burrows, but not just like one or two huge ones. This one is naturally arched up, and so it's basically the perfect tree for the purpose.
Smith says finding the right spruce took months. 10-time Iditarod finisher Travis Beals and Ben Ringler scoured the woods around Seward, dropping pins on their map app to mark candidates. Smith says they must have picked out over 30, but none of them were quite right.
We looked at each tree that they had marked. None of those were quite adequate. They had huge, huge burrows, but they weren't quite right for the arch, so we had to look further.
They expanded their search to the Chugach National Forest and finally, last October, found the perfect log.
And I figured it was very appropriate that we find a tree that came from nearly mile one of Iditarod Trail, and now it's going to travel all the way to the end and be the arch that symbolizes the end of many people's journeys in Nome.
One permit and a frigid 200-mile drive later, the log is now resting comfortably next to a blazing wood stove at Northern Spirit Rustics in Willow. Smith says the drying process will take a couple weeks, then he'll get to work on carving.
It's going to be bigger. The arch is going to be much stronger, but the wording is going to be very similar. We're going to probably carve in the names of many of the first people who finished Iditarod.
Those names include his parents, Bud Smith and Lolly Medley, both of whom competed in the Iditarod back in the 70s. He says the weight of the assignment is starting to hit him.
Just the symbolism of it, the journey that ends in Nome, the people's lives, you know, many people have spent decades, some of them have spent their whole life dreaming about traveling the Iditarod Trail.
Plans for unveiling the new arch are in the works. Smith expects it to be ready for the finish in Nome in just a month. Reporting just blocks from the Iditarod finish line, I'm Ben Townsend.
What do you get when you put the talents of a fisherman from Kasilof and a carpenter from Homer together? Well, as KNBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, their poetry and music go hand in hand, but not quite in the way you might expect.
The hand pan is a cousin to the steel pans of Trinidad and Tobago. Instruments made out of oil drums rescued from the trash. About 25 years ago, European instrument makers took the design to the next level. That's when Jim Maloney first got his hands on one.
Every time I play the handpan, it sounds like something from outer space. It's a very foreign sound, but it's also very euphoric, and it captures your attention.
The handpan also looks like it comes from outer space, like a mini flying saucer with bumps that produce five tones on a pentatonic scale. A simple instrument, but very hard to make. A paradox that resonates with this carpenter from Homer.
It's bent in a way that every single bend creates a certain note. It's pretty amazing.
Both Maloney and Steve Schoonmaker, who fishes out of Cordova, are big fans of music festivals. And finally, they crossed paths.
It was impromptu. A few summers ago, we were sitting in camp at Salmon Fest. Jim started playing the handpan, and we thought, ooh, we have something here.
I think that the most beautiful magic we've ever made is when we just show up.
When the two performed at the Anchorage Folk Festival recently, they came prepared, but hadn't rehearsed a lot.
First one is called Snowflake, and inclusion is the essential truth of creation.
Jim's handpan cuts a groove that Steve says he just rolls into. His poem is about a snowflake's journey from the sky to the water to becoming a source of life for salmon.
First, I was a snowflake. Then I was a glacier. But then I was a stone.
Fishing is a line of work that gives Schoonmaker downtime to write and commit his poems to memory.
But then once I memorize it, after a while, I work at it, the words kind of disappear and it becomes the imagery.
I'm just going off the feel of his words, his emotions, watching his hands. It's one of the most beautiful things about him as a poet is the way he physically describes things on stage when you're watching him.
I was a surf rolling in oxygen, nitrogen, and calcium. I was there when life begun. So unselfish. I was there, those tiny shellfish, feeding the salmon. Coming back, and then I was their fat, depleting, completing the cycles of snowflakes falling.
To Schoonmaker, these are more than just words. He says salmon face so many threats today, they need to have a voice.
Yes, they do. I feel sometimes I have a responsibility as a human to communicate at least my sincere feelings about our place in nature. Completing the cycles of snowflakes falling, calling into dangers yawning with the smells of spawning.
Together, a poet and a carpenter with words and a handpan, they create a sense of wonder.
First I was a snowflake, then I was a glacier, and then I was a stone.
In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Eric Stone and Clarice Larson in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Ben Townsend in Nome, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage. Special thanks to Wesley Early and Lori Townsend for filling in. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, offering guests hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and the Red Lantern Steak and Spirits Restaurant. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
Talk one-on-one with experts on mental health, nutrition, pharmacology, surgery, childcare, and much more on Line 1, Your Health Connection, weekly on your local public radio station.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
And fooled me twice. Baby, come around and we'll make nice. Don't give up and walk away. Stick it out, just stay and play. For you to make this work, I've got all day. Come on, baby, we'll find a way.
Jack and I need to get my story straight. My friends are in the bathroom getting higher than the Empire State. My lover, she is waiting for me just across the bar. My seat's been taken by some sunglasses asking about a scar. And I know I gave it to you months ago. I know you're trying to forget, but between the drinks and subtle things, the holes in my apologies, you know, I'm trying hard to take it back. So if by the time the bar closes and you feel like falling down, I'll carry you home tonight. Closes and you feel like falling down, I'll carry you home tonight.
Turn around, turn around.
chance for escape. They gave him new clothes in a Bible, and the word he did read out loud. The four walls can't keep him, because Charlie is free. Singing
the choice in
the choices you make might be mistakes. Never too late to turn around. Turn around, all the road that you take might lead you astray. Don't be afraid to turn around. Turn around, turn
when it comes to love. I did, and you were strong and I was not. My illusion, my mistake. I was careless, I forgot. I did. And now, when all is done, there is nothing to say. You have gone there so effortlessly. You have won, you can go ahead. Tell them all I know now. Shout it from the on the skyline, all we had is gold. Now tell them I was happy and my heart is broken. All my scars are open. Tell them what I hoped would be impossible. 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 Impossible.
Falling out of love is hard. Betrayal is worse. Broken trust and broken hearts. I know. And thinking all you need is there. Building faith on love and words. Empty promises will wear. I know. And now, when all is gone, there is nothing to say. And if you're done with embarrassing me, on your own, you could go ahead. Tell them all I know now.
ago, someone told me I should take caution when it comes to love. I did. Tell them all I know now. Shout it from the rooftop. Right on the sky. Someone told me I should take caution when it comes to love. I did.
Porsche. Rollie on my wrist, diamonds up and down my chain. Cardi B straight stunning, can't tell me nothing. Bossed up and I changed the game. It's my big bronze boogie, got all them girls shook. My big fat ass got all them boys cooked. We're from dollar bills and I be popping rubber bands. Bruno sang to me while I do my money dance. Like, flexing on the gram like, hit the little John, okay. Oh yeah, we dripping the finesse and getting paid.
There's a reason why they watch all night long. All night long. Woo! Yeah, I know we'll turn heads forever. So tonight I'm gonna show you off. When I walk up with you, I watch the whole room change. Baby, that's what you do. No, my baby don't play. Blaming on my confidence. Oh, blaming on your measurements. Shut this shit down on sight.
This is Dmitry Filimonov, President and CEO of the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association.
Over the last 5 years, APIA's Tribal Child Support Program has collected and distributed nearly $1.5 million, with 100% of those funds going to parents raising our next generation. We offer flexible and holistic case management to families. All residents of the Regional 10 communities are eligible for this alternative to state child support. To apply, please go to apiai.org or call 1-800-478-2742.
Remember, if you are in Anchorage, please come visit the Unangamula, home of the Aleuts. Unangam, Atakan, Akun. We are one.
This message...